Welcome to Sunday Sermons and other recordings from the Unitarian Universalist Church of Davis, California. Please visit our website at www.uudavis.org for further information.
Once again, welcome. I'm Cliff Omart, your worship associate this morning. We come together to know that we are part of something larger than ourselves, to know there is a place where we belong and where we are encouraged to live out our ideals. You are welcome in your fullness, your race and culture, sexual orientation, gender identity, religious views, or political party. Come to connect with community. Come to honor the earth. Come to claim your spirituality. Come to build the world that we dream is possible. If this is your first time in a service, we hope you'll stop by the welcome table out in the social hall so we can get to know you better. You will find that we are a caring, sharing community. This morning, you are invited to light a chalice at the back of the sanctuary and write in our milestone book. If you wish, we'll add your joy or sorrow to this morning's pastoral prayer or the caring corner in our bulletin. Please let us know if you would like to connect with a minister or a member of our caring team. To acknowledge all that is being held by the people in this room, we light one pillar candle for the sorrows of the world, the moments that weigh heavy on our hearts and minds. We light one pillar candle for the joys of the world, for the moments of hope and celebration and just plain fun. Let us center through music. This morning, to light our chalice, we have Barbara Meisner. Would you please come down and light the chalice for us? Barbara, I think a lot of you know. If you don't, you need to know her better. She was a Unitarian Universalist since the age of 12, although she didn't know it at the time. She signed the book early in the 1990s, and one thing we were talking about this morning, she was one of the pianists for this service before there was a permanent pianist hired. So she goes back. I'm sure some of you can remember that. She's been on the music task force in the Chalice Choir and currently the co-director of the Julie Bells. I don't know about you, but there's nothing like a bell choir, and it's just wonderful. I have Julie Bells here. The chalice is the flame. It's the symbol of the Unitarian Universalism. Our September chalice lighting words are by Julianne Lepp. We seek our place in the world and the answers to our heart's deep questions. As we seek, may our hearts be opened to unexpected answers. May the light of our chalice remind us that this is a community of warmth, of wisdom, and welcoming of multiple truths.
So it takes many people to create a space where our children and youth can explore our shared values as they discover their place in this world. Kate Logvey is our religious exploration coordinator. Woo! And supports our teachers and volunteers. Yes. And so, would our teachers, youth advisors, OWL facilitators, and classroom assistants please come forward? Every year we come together, as we did last week, for our water communion, which honors the experiences of our people and the ways that we share our lives with this community. And so today we use some of that same water to bless the hands of our teachers for their sacred work. A portion of this water was shared last week on our grounds. And Kate, through your hands, we create promise for tomorrow.
As Reverend Beth blesses these hands, I ask all of you to join in this blessing. So would you repeat after me? May your classes be a joy.
May your classes be a joy.
May they be spiritually fulfilling.
May they be spiritually fulfilling.
May they be places of growth.
May they be places of growth.
In giving we receive.
In giving we receive.
And we learn together.
And we learn together.
And you'll stay here and receive your children and youth. There are some programs that we don't see in this room, and we're grateful for the care and the facilitation offered. Our nursery is staffed every Sunday morning at both services by four loving attendants who deal with all sorts of noises. Cypher McGrath, Aaliyah Ahola, Alex Logvi, and Ariel Monsflod are our nursery care providers. And we're also really proud that we offer our whole lives comprehensive sexuality education. This fall, our elementary, upper elementary kids are doing OWL with Caitlin Legault, Debbie Chupp, and Jesse Stavely. And our junior high is meeting through the whole year with Hiram Jackson, Caitlin Legault, Jacob Sachs, Ginger G, and Lorraine Vischer. We give thanks for all of those folks. And now we will start to dismiss each class by your group. And so we start with the kindergarten and first graders. If you're in kindergarten and first grade, would you come on down here with Miss Mayer? This group are using two curricula this year, Creating Home, which helps children develop a sense of home that is grounded in Unitarian Universalism, and something called World of Wonder, which explores the direct experience in nature as an essential to children's physical, emotional, and spiritual development. Today, Mayer is helping out. Natalie Stoltzner is the regular teacher and often joined by Louise Conrad, and we will... We'll sing.
From you I receive. Class, come on down if you are here. This Explorers group is using two curricula, Faithful Journeys, which looks at Unitarian Universalist stories and rituals and values, and Moral Tales, which uses tales of the world's religions for kids to explore their own conscience and relationships with others in the earth. Rebecca Reichenbach is our lead teacher, and she's looking for some adult helpers, so that could be any one of you. And so, from you I receive.
Will our fourth, fifth, sixth graders come on down?
I think I might have seen some outside.
Here they come. Oh, they're all hanging out on this side of the sanctuary. I see. We call this group Chalice Council, and this year they're using a curriculum called the Bibelodeon, learning the most prominent stories from Jewish and Christian traditions through games and stories and plays, and looking at those stories with a modern UU lens. Willow Spicer is our lead teacher this year with support from Tiffany Eschbach. Have fun.
From you. And this year, our 7th, 8th, and 9th graders will see Shama Mesawala, joined by Bill Kurth and Lisa Britton. They meet in the library to discuss living their values and all aspects of their lives.
And they're going to go out the back.
Yeah. They do think differently.
They have their own way.
That's right.
And finally, we have our unique high school group. Come on down. Look, they're so brave. They're braver than the middle school group.
They're very cool.
There we have it. This year, our 10th, 11th, and 12th graders will meet in the office because we are out of space. So they have a cool space that they're sharing with the campus minister, and they meet to have meaningful conversations, small group worship, and so much more. And Caitlin Legault, Caitlin, I've said your name about a million times today. You're doing so much for us. Thank you, Caitlin. Caitlin is our youth coordinator, and she's joined this year by Sarah Larkin, Mark Eschbach, and Jacob Sachs sometimes. So have fun.
Fine. And as our children and youth begin their programming, I remind you that you are a part of this work too. So if you are inspired today and want to get more involved, please consider putting your name on the volunteer sign-up in the schedule at the RE cart, the Religious Exploration cart, in the social hall. When we are in community, we are all teachers and we are all learners. Thank you, Morgan.
Thank you. Thank and you. I'm off to the Birch House.
Bye. See you later. Yeah. From you I receive, to you I give, together. So true.
The reading today comes from a poem that was an inspiration for the writings of Nancy MacDonald Ladd, a main resource for Beth's sermon today. The Gates of Hope by Victoria Safford. Our mission is to plant ourselves at the gates of hope, not the prudent gates of optimism, which are somewhat narrower. Not the stalwart, boring gates of common sense, nor the strident gates of self-righteousness, which creak on shrill and angry hinges. People cannot hear us there. They cannot pass through. Nor the cheerful, flimsy garden gate of everything's gonna be all right, but a different, sometimes lonely place, the place of truth-telling, about your own soul, first of all, and its condition. The place of resistance and defiance. The piece of ground from which you see the world, both as it is and as it could be, as it will be. The place from which you glimpse not only struggle, but the joy of struggle. And we stand there beckoning and calling, telling people what we are seeing, asking people what they see. I wake up in the morning to a gloriously bright day. While I eat my breakfast of fresh, tangy orange juice, fried eggs over easy with luscious, runny yolks, and golden brown sourdough toast slathered with delicious butter, I feel good knowing that everyone else in my community is also able to enjoy a great breakfast of their choosing. A radio news report softly droning in the background suddenly catches my ear. The homeless crisis in the community is solved after many years of determined efforts by so many organizations and people. Everyone has a home. Breakfast is done, and I go outside to get into my electric car and head to the office. There is a slight chill in the air. It is so clean and fresh. It smells like fall. An aroma of rich earth, recent rain, and autumn leaves. I am thankful that I live in a community dedicated to maintaining the highest level of air quality. As I drive through town, I see couples out walking together in the fresh air under a deep blue sky. Men with women, men with men, women with women. There is a riot of brightly colored clothing on display reflecting the wearer's ethnic heritage. I see a deep turquoise caftan, a rich burnt orange sari with beautiful patterns, a brightly colored Mexican serape, and someone wearing a kilt. How natural it all feels. It is great to return to my former office. I retired a couple of years ago, made possible by a generous Social Security program. The company I work for has provided office space for me to do small consulting projects for them in my retirement. It keeps my intellectual juices flowing and gives me a feeling of self-worth. About mid-morning, I peruse the announcement of a new member of the company's board of directors, bringing the number of women on the board to 6 out of 10. I feel lucky to have been employed by a company that worked for many years to equalize men's and women's pay scales and ensure equal opportunity for members of minority groups. I also see a notice about a grant the company just awarded to a black transgender valued colleague of mine that they are using to help settle 3 families from Honduras who are fleeing persecution. As I drive home, I cannot help but notice the diversity in the racial makeup of the people on the sidewalks and marveling at how the community has changed over the years in this regard. Sounds great, doesn't it? Or at least to some people it sounds great. Probably others not much. When I put thought into my utopia, what it would be like, I was fascinated that the more I thought about it, the more questions came to me that I realized needed to be answered to do justice to the effort. What are the values of my utopia? What are they based on? What is the driving force underpinning it? Who would be in it? What happens when inevitably a member does not agree with all that is happening in the community? I realized I'd gone through a miniature evolutionary process in trying to describe my utopia, and I'd learned some things about myself. I recommend you try it too. What would your utopia look like, and why?
So if we were in a tent revival worship, and I'm going to take you back to the mid-1800s, a long time ago, the seats right here, well, especially in the front, but today I'm going to include you, everyone all the way back, would be reserved for people with a very special role. Not you. Only them. They weren't ushered to these seats, and this is the role of our ushers, you know, would show them to the seats, because they would nod off during the sermons. You might, but not them. Neither were they accompanied to the center front, because they were a part of the esteemed leadership. No. They were seated where the preacher could watch them. And they were understood to be both promising but problematic. So everyone take a good look at who's sitting there today. But I want to tell you that if they had been the majority of the gatherings rather than the minority, the acceptable attitude of our country's leadership would be very different. So pay attention to what I say about these people. And if any time in the sermon that you think I really belong there, you have my permission to get up and go there. And I'm very serious about that. We had some people at the 9:30 who were seriously contemplating it. And I think if I told them they could do it, they would have done it. So in 1519, I'm going back even more, Sir Thomas More created this word utopia to describe an imaginary island off the coast of the Americas. So 1519, off the coast of the Americas, it's got to be imaginary. He wanted a place from the struggles, far away from the struggles in England. And in this place, perfect social and economic conditions were enjoyed by everyone on this island. It was probably the equivalent to 1519 of Cliff's utopia. Today we use this part of More's definition of utopia. It was picked up by the populace right away. The perfect society. Throughout our history as a country, visionaries have responded to the difficulties of their time by trying to establish a perfect utopian communities. It's not here, but it's out there. And how they created these utopian communities and the characteristics of each one reflect how they understood perfection. And you'll notice I keep coming back to this perfection and no fault. Several things happened simultaneously in our country. One was the expansion of settlers moving across the continent. Within just 150 years, we suddenly completely populated the continent. And what paralleled that was a revival of a particular message, a particular kind of religion. Both established religions in those churches and the emerging new religious communities. And I want you to think, we have currently today established churches, and we have lots of emerging experimental religious communities today. There was an overwhelming certainty, and this is what held all of these groups together, an overwhelming certainty that we, the American people, were destined to perfection. If we would just continue to learn and improve our character and our intellect, we could continue in an upward trajectory of accumulation of wealth equals land and opportunity. And opportunity. There was actually a universalist preacher who talked about onward and upward forever. That actually sounds really exhausting to me. To clarify who is included in the word we, it's the population who was white and predominantly Northern European in heritage. There was one time in our history, just this one time, and a very specific geographic area. Actually, it's within a day's drive of one end of it to another today. And that, in that one location and at this one time, the message that came from that time and place imprinted in the consciousness of our country and has informed how we live together and also how we interact internationally. As soon as the land that is now Western New York State, which people thought of as really far west at one point, as soon as it was available to be settled, 10% of the population living along that eastern seaboard moved to claim it. That meant 800,000 Americans, most of them under the age of 35, who could think about onward and upward forever, settled this new frontier. There were at least 130 utopian communities created in the United States in this one time frame, in the mid-1800s, and 100,000 people were a part of those experiments. Even the experimentation of the 1960s with drugs and sex and communal living really couldn't, if you size them up, overshadow the importance of the 1840s, although that is very hard to believe. It is true. Revival meetings were the cornerstone for the growing communities of settlers moving west, and the preachers challenged their listeners to follow principles that would bring heaven to earth. Perfectionism, again. These religious gatherings looked spontaneous, but I learned this summer that they were really very highly orchestrated events. The people who attended these, and certainly the leadership, believed that the improvement of society could be started right there. If an individual could accept the challenge to strive for perfection, their achievement would spread to the community. And the change in the community would inspire all of society. And if our society embraced the ideals, then surely the world would follow our example. And then the world could achieve its potential. It sounds a lot like American exceptionalism, they call it, and the idea that if only they would accept our form of democracy, all would be well in the world. You can see it's not so different now. The revival meetings in Western New York State had special seats. So we're coming to those special seats again. Are you ready? It was called the Anxious Bench. And it was right in front of the preacher. And if there was evidence that a person had doubts about their faith, and Ralph Robinson, our head usher, I want you to hear, this is going to be your role in the future. If someone you know has doubts about their faith, you bring them right here. You bring them front center. And in the revivals, there was an effort to speak to the depths of each person's life directly. I mean, directly right at them. And so the person preaching would look into the eyes of the people sitting on the anxious bench and come right up to them and talk to them. Being seated on the anxious bench, it sounds kind of anxiety-producing, doesn't it? You can think of it as the doubting bench, in a way. It wasn't seen as a positive thing in the time. But I think We needed more people who doubted, not themselves, but the message of onward and upward forever. The anxious bench, the doubting bench, should have been so full that people would have fallen off the end, that ushers would need to bring in row after row of benches for the overflowing middle section right up to the preacher. This should have been where everyone would be sitting. I'll bet you the doubters are in the very back here. I don't know if the revivals fired up people to start new communities or if it worked the other way around, but the two went hand in hand. The communal living of those 1960s, and I hear many people talk about the joys of that, well, they were very similar to the 1840s. There were some communities that denied sexual relations among their members. I didn't hear much about that in the 1960s. But there were communities that encouraged free love. And the lecturer I heard this summer said that in his Mormon class, when people looked like they were getting sleepy, he would start to mention these utopian communities of free love, and everyone would suddenly wake up. Although a couple could be monogamous, it wasn't really encouraged. They really didn't want couples. You were to be free with your love. Some utopian communities encouraged perfecting all human relationships with a focus on learning and social equality. Those were the Unitarians, by the way. Another banned cotton clothing because its production exploited those who were enslaved. They banned using all products from animals and believed that the animals should not lose their lives for our benefit, and neither should their labor be exploited. Those were the Universalists, in case you're wondering. And from his home in Boston, Unitarian minister and essayist Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote, "We are all a little wild here, with numerous projects of social reform. There is not a reading man who does not but have a copy of a new utopian community in his waistcoat pocket." But the hope that they had in their hearts, right under that waistcoat pocket, was not the hope that Victoria Safford wrote about in her poem. Their hope was the hope of optimism and certainty. You would never find them on the anxious bench or the doubting bench ever. Good things happened. These people were very daring. They went into action. They addressed social justice issues at the time, the abolition of slavery, temperance, which, by the way, was more about the treatment of women than denying alcohol, suffrage and the right for women to vote. All of this came out of that one geographic area and then spread across the country. This was the place of the beginning of communities championing the workers' rights and resisting industrialization. So, I just want to say, if you are uncertain about what we should be addressing in our time, there are so many issues you can't decide what we should address and how we should do it, then there's a place for you right here on the anxious bench or the doubting bench. If you're not sure what helps you sustain your life, to live your ideals, then this center space is where you belong, not on the edges. It is possible that there won't be enough space for all of us to fit on the anxious bench. And that reflective, doubting space, where we doubt our perfection, is important for each one of us. And for our society. It is the place of humbleness because we are not sure that we are right with ourselves. We wonder if we have the right truth, the whole truth, If we really know the answers, are we really being authentic? That's when we sit on the anxious bench. Not all utopian communities had their roots in religion, so if you are a humanist or atheist among us, you will be relieved to know that there is a message for you, but it is no better. The Reverend Nancy McDonald Ladd wrote the history of her hometown, New Harmony, Indiana. It was built on the scientific humanist ideals of the time. The ideals were of a community where all would share in this social and economic plenty. The participants believed in the common ownership of property, opportunities for educational advancement, and the encouragement of scientific inquiry. In 1827, what became referred to as the boatload of knowledge traveled down the Ohio River to New Harmony. It was referred to as the most significant intellectual migration in American history. And Ralph Waldo Emerson was on this boat. It seems that he couldn't resist sampling utopian efforts, and I found his name in several utopias, and he never enjoyed one of them. He always returned home. Home was best. New Harmony was the seed of a new society, and on that boat with poets, geologists, educators, lecturers, intellectuals, and it was assumed that when other communities saw the success of this perfect, and they called it the village of unity and mutual cooperation, they would immediately want to replicate the model. Soon, American society would be reformed, and you can see where this goes. Other nations would follow the country's example, and the world would be great. They thought, well, if people could just get beyond religion and culture and family loyalty, there would be complete happiness. Yes, thank you for laughing for me. Of all the people, all the time, everywhere. That's a quote from their charter. There were problems from the start, as you can imagine. You probably can't wait to hear what they were. There was no one who knew how to grow food, number one. Work with animals, number two. I mean, the Universalists really loved their animals, obviously, but this was a different story. Deal with the winter weather, number three. And all that intellectual knowledge embodied in those poets and essayists, you know, and teachers arrived in the midst of an Indiana winter. That's when they disembarked the boat of knowledge. There were other inhabitants of New Hope, too. The opportunity to create a new moral world, they called it, had been advertised widely. So unskilled laborers answered this invitation, and they showed up at New Hope, arriving, looking for work. So they weren't really invested in the ideals. Their ideals was, let's eat, let's have food. And you know there was a problem with the food, right? So there were also people that were later described, and I love this language, unprincipled sharpers. I've never heard it before, but I know exactly what it means. Who had no intention of contributing in a positive way to that community. Their interest was in benefiting from the goodness of others. So they were there, well, you know, to take advantage of these people who seemed quite clueless, and that was clear. The combined population included intellectuals with high ideals, unskilled laborers looking for work when there was no work, and people of doubtful character. This is not a winning combination to create unity and mutual cooperation, and it was described as a very odd gathering of people. But there were also people, and we need to mention this, who were excluded from that invitation to begin this social experiment of wonderfulness, of happiness for everybody. The indigenous people who had lived on that land were excluded, never to be included. The farmers who had settled on the land had been removed. And although many of the intellectuals were abolitionists, no people of color were allowed to be residents in New Harmony. People of color is precisely the language used in their visionary document, and only people with white skin were allowed. From the beginning, the ideals started to unravel. Not only were people hungry, there was no work. Everyone was expected to do manual labor. However, the wealthy had the ability to pay others to do their share of the tasks. The farming tools were left unused in the barns that had been abandoned. And within a few months, people were buying food from the farmers outside the community, probably the very people they had displaced. By the way, they moved to this community, that boatload of intellectuals. Another utopian community had failed, and the two leaders exchanged keys to the buildings, and it became a new utopian community, much like it was described, buying a lake home. And all the silverware is there, the beds, the furnishings. So that's how these intellectuals came to land in a place and imagine they could ever do anything. It was all prepared for them. The intellectuals couldn't relate to the residents who were poor laborers. The laborers were not interested in being reformed, quite honestly, to become more intellectually refined. They simply wanted jobs. And the belief that they were morally inferior because of the level of education or their class, that was repugnant. This was especially true when it was known that the elite were buying their way out of sharing the labor equally. Their sense of moral superiority was inauthentic. This dynamic was also obvious to those who were outside the community and wanted to be wooed to join New Harmony for their skills. Who would want to risk their own economic well-being on an unstable system where the dream was so far from reality? Within 18 months, the village of unity and mutual cooperation dissolved. 18 months. And that actually is a long time. So the universalist utopia that I mentioned, where they, you know, didn't wear cotton and where they didn't have any animal products, those people left within the year because they were hungry and they were malnourished because they didn't know how to take care of themselves. So many times they would barely last a year as a utopian community. Within that 18 months, New Harmony became a traditional town where individual families owned their private property again, just as they had before. And again, in this town, good things did happen. The first public library was established. This is where the movement for public schools gained community support. Good came from the experiment, but at a tremendous price. The price was lost wealth. That's the least of it. Lost trust, disbelief that people deserved or could find happiness. Remember, that was their original goal. Disbelief that you can even cultivate character or people are worth it. But the doubt that would have benefited them, that would have placed them right here and would have been a good place for them, would have been to suspect the truth that they had accepted. That wealth and class was a sign of wisdom. That, please, doubt that. Or the doubt that a sustainable life could be achieved through exclusion of others. Or the doubt that perfection was available without some kind of conflict and discomfort. The doubt that those with the most in the society didn't need to listen to those with the least in society. Utopia is not created without conflict and disagreement, that is shaped by deep listening and a desire to change. And so Cliff's utopia, I told him I wouldn't leave him hanging out there with this amazing vision of a utopia. What he has the end result. So what Cliff didn't do was to, he didn't have time, was the whole backstory of what it took to get to this thing he was able to imagine with such beauty. We would have been here for a very long time, as we may be if we can ever get there. I was blessed to be in the congregation this summer with the Reverend Otis Moss Jr. III preaching, and I didn't know about him and discovered that all these other UU clergy were texting each other and sending messages on Facebook, and I thought, my God, there are like five other UUs here in Chautauqua, and I didn't know it, and they were here because of this minister. His message that morning that I was listening to him was about how building a bridge or an arching gate is much more difficult than building a wall. To build a bridge, we need to understand design and geometry and the laws of physics. And a wall, anybody can build something straight up. Creating a utopia is like building a bridge that arches the many ways that people can be divided. And we need a few more skills to not mistake an inauthentic utopia for the real thing. Our theology as a denomination doesn't encourage us to sit on the bench of anxiety, the bench of doubt. We like to ask questions. But when it comes to doubting our personal rightness, to admitting our faults, to asking for forgiveness, to understanding that we are far from perfect, we don't do that very well. We like to think that we're just a little above average. Jason Shelton, the composer and minister who wrote Standing on the Side of Love, that we call Answering the Call of Love, and many other favorite songs, did a study of music, the music that we sing in all the liturgy, the readings in the back of our hymnal. And he looked for worship, anything in worship that expressed lamentation, our regret. First of all, you have to admit that you've made mistakes, but our regret that we have made mistakes, or asking for forgiveness for that. In the 1950s, in those hymnals, and I'm going to go back because I have them back to my grandfather, there are many different liturgies that admit we've messed up. Here we are. Can we forgive each other? But in the 60s, they completely disappeared. Completely. He found one. Rob Eller Isaacs has something that is used for the Jewish High Holy Days often. We need to doubt ourselves sometimes and accept that we are not perfect, not shaming each other. That's different. But to say, I messed up. I'm going to try again. I'm going to do it differently. I'm going to learn. And maybe even, will you forgive me? Imagine that we are waiting at Victoria Safford's Gates of Hope. If we are that person waiting at that gate of hope, and it is in her poem, we know heartache that was caused by others and the heartache that we caused. We know that hope isn't always cheerful. We know the role of resistance and even defiance. We recognize the importance of truth-telling in hope. And there is the ability to not only speak, but to listen to the experiences of others. Hope accepts that we have the ability to admit that we are rarely, if ever, perfect. And it requires that we stay for the hard moments of uncertainty, self-doubt, and reflection on the direction of the whole complicated society in which we live. Sometimes it's good, I'm going to tell you, to be on that anxious bench, on the bench of doubt, and to stay there and to see what it has to teach us. The definition of utopia uses only a portion of Sir Thomas More's intention. He created that word utopia from combining the Greek words for no and place. Utopia is no place. It does not exist. But even in his day, society quickly latched on to the beginning of his intent to talk about an island that was so wonderful. But his real intention was to say, and that place doesn't really exist. We were so eager. And so it is with Victoria Safford, with Nancy McDonald Ladd, with Reverend Otis Moss Jr. III. The true utopia is not a place of harmony. It is where there are crowds of people on that anxious bench, on that doubting bench, because they are reflecting and considering the possibilities in their own heart. They are living with a tension of different points of view and truth-telling, with humbleness, knowing that everyone has been wrong and everyone deserves respect. And in that true utopia, people are willing to admit that perfection is beyond their reach. And they are looking, they are looking, they are listening as they build a new way. And when we sing that song this month as our hymn of the month, who is the we in that song? And what is it that we're building? And who is with us as whatever that is being built? And I invite you to join me on the doubting bench at very least. And it may be a little anxiety producing, but I'll be there with you. And amen. I invite you into a time of prayer and meditation. A time when you can look within and be at peace with your own spirit, your own body. Spirit, blessed is your true name. We pray for your peace to come. We pray that your goodwill will be done, to let heaven and earth become one. Give us this day the bread we need. Give it to those who have none. Let forgiveness flow like a river between us, from each one to each one to each one. Lead us to holy innocence, beyond the evil of our days. Come, Spirit, come. For yours is the power and the glory and the mercy forever, all in one. Each of us is an intricate part of a web of relationships. When one of us celebrates a joy or grieves a loss, the web of life moves to a new shape. We are a part of the turn of the earth, the shift of the stars, the pull of the sea, and all change. Sometimes our lament. We take hands around the room, or shoulders, touching shoulders, something. Go now in peace. Deeply regard each other.
Truly listen to each other. Speak what each of you must speak. Be ready in every moment to disarm your own heart.
Rejoice in this love that you have begun. And let this gathering say, amen.
Amen.